Hello and welcome back to the Synergy Autism Podcast, where we are seeking to understand autism together. Today's podcast is another conversation with Blake Baxter. In this podcast, we explore the PDA profile of autism, and I think you will really enjoy this conversation. So come on in.
Synergy Autism Podcast.
Let's talk about PDA, and we don't mean public displays of affection.
No.
Whenever I say PDA, I'll say to families every once in a while, have you heard of PDA? And they look at me really funny and I go, oh, right. It's pathological demand avoidance.
Right. It's not a, I thought we were talking about personal digital assistance. Is that what we're talking about today?
Not that either. No. Also known as persistent drive for autonomy.
Persistent drive for autonomy. I've also heard pervasive drive for autonomy.
Pervasive drive for autonomy.
I've heard both. I've heard both.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I've heard both. Yeah.
And what I know is that it was first identified in the 80s in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And that it is still not an official diagnosis, but more of a profile of autism.
Right.
Now,
I find that notion of profile to be very interesting, actually. I think it's the only profile of autism. It's the only...
Yet. Don't you feel like we might be moving into like different profiles of autism?
Yes. Justifiably so.
Yeah. Right?
We kind of... With the DSM-5, I guess they eliminated some things like Asperger's and as a separate diagnosis and put everything under ASD, autism spectrum disorder, and word I have a problem with. But I think that that PDA shows that there's limitations to the diagnostic criteria right now that can prevent or make it difficult to make an autism diagnosis without a focused profile like this one is. Because some of the things about the PDA profile of autism, some of those characteristics seem to be kind of the opposite of what would be the criteria for autism. You don't have all of them. Some of them are quite different. And it reminds me of something that happened during my diagnosis, which was, I was told it was level one autism. And I said, so would that have been Asperger's? And she said, no, I wouldn't have given you an Asperger's diagnosis.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I said, why? And I wish I could remember better exactly what she said. At the moment I was taking it all in, and it was kind of crazy. Sure. But it has something to do with the way I talked and the way I would verbalize. And, essentially something, I mean, to generalize in a very kind of vague way, but that an Asperger's diagnosis would traditionally involve a lot more talking. Somebody who's very verbose.
Yes. So usually they would say with Asperger's, somebody who didn't actually have delays in like length and ability to describe things, that kind of thing. Which always threw me a little bit because there is that social aspect and you can't get away from, I don't know, trying to separate communication and social is really hard for me in my brain because all communication is social. But kind of the monologuing happened more often in Asperger's than maybe.
Yes, exactly. Like monologuing. Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Thank you. Yes. So, and unfortunately, she's passed away. She was.
Oh wow.
Yeah, she was older, but she had been doing autism diagnoses for close to 30 years. So she was been doing it for a long time.
Wow.
Also had her JD. She was an attorney. So, and a PhD. So she would do expert testimony. She was very active in the justice system and with Child Protective Services. and explaining what autism is and making diagnoses. Mm-hmm. I thought that.
I mean, that's another, I think every time we meet, we think, oh, there's another podcast we need to do. Because autism is a justice.
Well, because, you know, they just killed this kid.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. So.
In California.
Yeah, no, in this county.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Horrific.
My sheriff. I mean, yeah, oh, really? You know, county sheriff here. Yeah. I mean, I saw the video. The kid charged him with a garden tool, but.
I saw it too.
Honestly, I mean, I'm not a police officer. I've never been in that role, you know, but I've seen plenty of videos of police officers in other countries just taking people down without shooting them because yeah. they're trained to do so. This is a, I don't know how old he was, a teenager?
He was, yeah.
You know, and these cops were much bigger than he was. There's got to be another way, right? And the San Bernardino County Sheriff said something which I actually kind of agree with. He's like, my deputy should not be responding to these calls. And I was like, yeah, you're right. They should, you know, I mean, they may be backing up these calls, but no, you need a trained intervention taking place here.
I also think that we need a better way to alert first responders that somebody might have difference in how they're going to present when an officer comes. I know that a lot of different.
Well, they knew it.
Oh, they did know that he had autism.
They were told, and at least two of the officers or deputies who responded had been there before. So I think they knew. Maybe the first one to arrive might not have been aware, but it sounded like there was at least some awareness. But still, what does that mean, right? Even if they did know, do they know what to do? Do they know what to expect? We definitely need more resources and I think law enforcement's calling for it too, right? And we've kind of stepped away from the notion that social services are a good idea. And we have too many people who think social services equals socialism.
Right.
Or communism. And, you know.
Okay, we're not going to go down that path.
Two different words for a reason. Anyway.
I'm going to back up, though, because I also really strongly feel like there's a good chance that that family had not been supported to know what to do either, right? And so they are in crisis. Right. They're going to call who, right? But there aren't enough people to support parents or families in understanding autism and to know what to do to avoid crisis.
So I saw a really interesting post on social media. I won't get specific, but it was a post about empathy. And the post said that autistic people don't have empathy is a myth. And then it said a couple things afterwards to the notion that autistic people are loaded with empathy, right? And someone responded on the post and said, well, my grandson is autistic and he's never had any empathy for anything, any creature. And my son is the same way. He would attack other children and hurt animals. But we worked with him and with the right, I think she said medication and therapies today, he's just my like big lovable teddy bear or something. And she's talking about an adult. And I thought to myself, she doesn't know what she's talking about. This is a woman with an autistic son and an autistic grandchild, both of whom have profound challenges. Mm-hmm. And she thinks they're the way they are because of the autism. Now, autistic people are just like everyone else. Mm-hmm. Some percentage of autistic people are going to have other conditions and psychological dispositions. And it doesn't mean it's because of the autism, but the thing that struck me the most about it is here is a person who's been dealing with this for two generations and it still doesn't have a clue.
It's
incredibly sad.
Well, and you know, I always say that I don't chase clients because somebody has to be asking questions to be able to hear it, right? Somebody has to be curious about more. That sounds like somebody who's already figured, you know, decided this is how, you know, this is my mindset about my son and about autism and must not be looking out and curious, because there is today so much more out there if somebody is curious and wants to learn. Either that or they're dealing with their own, you know, lives and needs that are clouding things, own depression, own mental health issues. I mean, there's so much. It goes on and on and on.
And, you know, economically disadvantaged.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, people just don't have the extra time to learn something new.
Yeah.
And, you know, become expert at it and be able to engage new modes of behavior and new ways of thinking and experimenting and really working with another person. I mean, a lot of people don't have time for that.
Yeah. Well, let's go get back to PDA, because we are talking about helping people understand something. And I think that what that touches on too.
Right. There's a profile.
Yeah.
And it says, you might be seeing this, and this gives us a lens into autism. Right. And we remove that with Asperger's and said everything's now with autism spectrum disorder. And I think we will start to see, like you said, it's the first profile yet. I think profiles make sense. And I think Asperger's, or a different name if people have a problem with it, could come back as a profile.
Yeah.
Because it can be differentiated from other forms of autism or other levels of autism, where it's differentiated outside of the level model, right? Three levels. And, you know, within that, it's too large of a set of criteria that can occur in too many varieties. Right? Too many different combinations for, I think, a pediatrician or, you know.
Well, just the idea that, I mean, people like you have autism who are, you know, holding down a wonderful job and married and et cetera, et cetera. And there are also autistic individuals who may not have communication as fluidly, if at all. And be struggling to find a job.
Right. So,
yeah. The other thing that I was thinking that I like as kind of a bringing in the profile discussion with what you were just saying, that some people may not understand autism, right? And this PDA profile does help people understand the profile that they've been calling lazy or defiant, or, you know, the subsection of autism that doesn't fit, like you were saying, doesn't fit the criteria exactly. And so a lot of families have looked to PDA when they are frustrated, because they're trying to connect with other parents who have kids with autism. They're trying to better understand the autism diagnosis. And they're going, hey, wait a minute. I mean, just the fact that one of the markers of PDA is actually having an imaginary play and being really imaginative, right? That's something that is pretty significantly not in a typical autism profile, whatever that is, right?
Right. Right. And so I think within a PDA profile, a child can be, or a person can be, want to socialize.
Yeah.
Right. And not be adverse to it. And I also think what I've been reading is that the marker of language, right, ability might not be present as well in a PDA profile. Right. The marker of language development in early years.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think that's where it's going to get messy when we start looking at the profiles, because I know many autistic individuals with different presentations.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have people that I work with who might meet the PDA profile who also don't have high communication use, verbal communication use.
Right.
But they're still having this, and one of the biggest markers, in my opinion, is having a fight or flight response to any demand.
Yes, right. To have the, I mean, probably what we're going to find is the amygdala,
mm-hmm.
right, being a little
overactive or
hyperactive, overactive, right?
Yeah.
Which isn't always a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know, I always come back to this, like, this notion of like the oppositional sensory, oppositional pheromone response studies that are just like so fascinating, which is in a large crowd of people who are all feeling very calm, autistic people tend to be anxious.
Oh, yeah.
Suspicious. And then in a large room full of people that are panicking, autistic people kind of become calm and see through the din to something that might need to be done. And the studies have taken place in actual rooms where pheromones are being released and studying the reactions of people. And I just thought obviously this is a function of the mind, is the brain, right? Acting, having a chemical reaction is different. Because the structure differently. And I think with PEA, the thing that fascinates me that I actually relate to very well is even things I enjoy doing feel like a demand. Even something I'm looking forward to, going and doing it causes me anxiety and can be fatiguing.
Yeah.
Even though I like doing it. And the notion even that that attention, positive attention or praise can feel like a demand. Right. Yeah. Somehow related to just the notion that I have to I think of it in a couple different ways. So if sensory issues are a thing, right? If I know that changing environments, things are, or even, you know, something I like doing might require a change in my environment.
Okay.
Even if it's minimal, right? It takes me away from stasis, which is a comfortable place for me to be if I can get to a point where like my fight or flight responses aren't firing.
Yeah. Can you give an example of something you want to do, but you have to change your environment to do it?
Well, it could be something as simple as turning on a light and picking up a book.
Okay.
Or transitioning into using the computer to do something I want to do, right? Mm-hmm. But if it involves actually going somewhere, like going out in public, playing sports, going to a museum, going to a concert, going to a movie. I can't go to movies anymore. I used to enjoy going to movies. I love the big screen and the sound. And over time, it turned into I can only sit in the back row of a movie theater. But now I can't enjoy them at all at this point in my life because I'm totally distracted by all the people, and the smells, the sounds. And things have gotten worse because now everybody is eating in movie theaters all the time.
Well, and post-COVID. I mean, I feel like everything that we see. Just blown to a new level in autism, what we see. Yes. Like, so everybody's experiencing some of that, but in autism, it's like untenable, you know?
Right. So even things I enjoy doing, they require a change of environment.
Mm-hmm.
Something.
Are you feeling like you identify with PDA then?
You know, it's really interesting. I'm some of those things for sure. Those two things for sure.
Uh-huh.
Right. And it's like, once you get there and you start having a good time, and that's true, I might forget about it, but I know that there's going to be the battery's getting drained. Mm-hmm. And people don't understand when I say, how long are we going to be there? About what time do you think we're heading back? What are we doing after that? Oh, don't worry about it. No, we're having fun. Well, if I don't have those times, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not having fun.
Right.
Because I'm gauging. I have a pretty good idea at this point in my life, like how much energy I have for certain types of situations. Yeah. And I'm trying to gauge it so I can be part of it and so that I can do things that I enjoy. Right. But I have to measure that in kind of a separate different way. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that a lot of people get energy from socializing. They get a net energy gain, right? And as much as I can enjoy socializing at times, as much as I enjoy conversation about things that I'm interested in, there's still a net energy loss, mm-hmm. even though overall I know it's good for me, mm-hmm. right? In the long run, to not always be like sitting in this exact same position in the exact same room, right? You know,
right.
Eating the exact same thing, right? As much as that's a comfortable space for me, mm-hmm. it's hard to grow. So growth requires a certain amount of compromise and vulnerability. And as human beings, when we go into the world and into a vulnerable way, there's a certain amount of support socially from other people who experience vulnerability in the same way. But autistic people experience vulnerability in a unique way. And so the world, quote unquote, isn't structured in that way for autistic people. And so I don't have any problem with the demand word in PDA. I do have a problem with the pathological word, but demand avoidance, that is what it feels like, right?
Yeah, because and I think what I struggle with is the difference between the autistic experience that you've described a lot of around the energy reserves about, you know, and getting exhausted by decision-making and social engagements mm-hmm. and things like that. That is a very autistic response. I think what I'd love to go a little bit further into is what you just talked about of how autistic individuals, probably with a PDA profile, exist within social systems differently in the sense of what I've heard is like this hierarchy of people is not as, so I hear this a lot from kids, right? Or parents of kids who often part of the PDA profile is that kids are not seeing their parents as authority figures.
Right.
They see them as equals.
Right.
And that is so confusing for parents who are thinking, well, I just tell them to do it and they'll do it. Right. But for the child who has autism and PDA profile is going, hey, wait a minute, my loss of autonomy here is sending my nervous system into overdrive.
Right.
I just, that part of the PDA profile is so interesting to me, like to think about navigating the world with a different sense of, just social hierarchy stuff. It'd be interesting to find out, like, even, what PDA profiles look like in different cultures too.
In different cultures.
Would be yeah. so fascinating.
And I think also as we start to recognize PDA in adults.
Yeah.
We see diagnosis as adults or who aren't diagnosed. Like, how do you identify PDA in adults who hasn't received a diagnosis yet? When again, and this is true for, I think a lot of it is, you know, most of the diagnostic criteria are built around, you know, identifying autism in children.
Yeah.
But what will that look like? You know, how does it relate to the notion that 85% of autistic people are unemployed? Because when you're working to have a job, you are existing in a hierarchy. In all likelihood, you have a boss, and that boss has a boss.
Yeah.
And you have some kind of understanding or ability to work within a hierarchy for it's most jobs. In fact, most jobs, that's like the job.
Right?
Right? That's it. You could do that, you know.
Well, that would be interesting to see then how many autistic adults who meet the PDA profile actually might run, like have their own businesses because they can't work within that system. I have a guy right now that I strongly suspect as being on PDA profile, whatever. And he doesn't identify as autistic or PDA. So I haven't brought it up to him necessarily, but holy moly, he's tortured. Every time he makes a decision of something he wants for himself, he will doubt himself, change mm-hmm. it. He can't get himself to actually do the thing that he knows he wants to do. Mm-hmm. And it just seems so painful.
So there's an element of time here, right? Where what's the rush?
What do you mean?
Well, the notion that the notion that autistic people experience time differently.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
So, you know, if something's a demand, then there has to be a time element associated to it. Mm. Otherwise, it's not a demand.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Do it sometime in the next 30 years. Okay.
Yep.
That's not triggering my amygdala. You know, I'm not. But still, you know. Right. You can push it off far enough. So there's definitely an experience of time here. And the notion of, you know, attention shifting, right?
Yeah.
Being different for autistic people, really kind of fleshing out of the conversation, right? Before moving on to the next topic in a conversation mm-hmm. and being frustrated in social situations because people seem to go from thing to thing to thing without actually going deep into anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
Is an element, I think, something influenced by us being stuck in time. And so what the expectation might not be experienced as a demand if the time is adjusted somehow. Right? Like, so in school, I never did anything until the night before.
Mm-hmm.
Until I had only the minimum required of time left to do it. It was a bad habit. I knew it was a bad habit. And we thought it was procrastination.
Mm-hmm.
It's not procrastination. It was like, this subject is so easy for me to deal with. And this paper is going to be so easy for me to write that I'm not going to do it until I have like 10 o'clock the night before or something like that. And it's not because I had too many other things to do. And, but it was because why should I even do this until I've got better things to do with my time. Why should I even do this until the minimum amount of time left for me to do?
Interesting though. What I experience is that's what people experience, but they're not saying that necessarily to themselves. They're often beating themselves up. Why can't I do
it? Right. I thought I was a procrastinator. I thought something wrong with me, that I was defective. I couldn't start a task. I couldn't even do it. And on the occasion that I did do something early, for whatever reason, I would be like, oh, wow, this is like, I just gained time. Right. It's done. Right. Yeah. Now I have all this time in between. But the difference in what it did to me kind of, you know, psychologically was profound. I could definitely feel the difference between, you know, doing something right at the very last minute, even though I could, right? Versus doing it earlier than I needed to and suddenly having free time, so to speak.
With the PDA profile, what I also hear, so I think it was an article you sent that was in Medium, I think mm-hmm. that's what I'm remembering, but where it was written by a woman who, if she knew she was going to do laundry on Wednesday, mm-hmm. she was fine with it. Like, okay, I'm going to do it on Wednesday. But as soon as her husband on Tuesday said, oh, you got to do laundry tomorrow, it would just be like, nope. Not going to happen.
No, I can't do it. I was going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
But now that you've made it into a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, so what I'm finding is a lot of people are saying, okay, what do you do about it? Right? Because I do work with a lot of families who are going, oh, they have adult children or they have younger children, whatever, that they're trying to figure out, how do I navigate this PDA profile to motivate somebody to get, you know, to figure out how to address the things that they want for themselves. And one thing that I'm finding is, yes, choices, giving somebody choices. But the other thing is, like with that woman, if the husband had come in and said, I see the laundry needs to be done. Do you have a plan for that? That might have been a better way of, she could have then said, oh yeah, I'm doing it on Wednesday. Where then maybe that would have been easier. Is that true? Rather than, I hope you do the laundry tomorrow, Wednesday.
It's, I almost can't think of a good way to say it. Right?
Okay.
You know what I mean? It's really tough. Like, if you know someone's doing the laundry tomorrow, why are you asking them?
Well, but he must not have known, I guess. Right, of course. So trusting the person, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, right. And maybe that's it, is trusting and having higher expectations for the person rather than, I mean, I'm always trying to remove or help people reduce prompts, right? Because prompts across the board take somebody's autonomy away. And with somebody who has PDA, it's going to be not only take their autonomy away, but they're going to get backlash, both within the child or the person system, but then between you, you're going to have that backlash.
Which is again, brings us to the notion of these, like, where profiles can be helpful, because some autistic people are very prompt driven. In fact, they're only prompt driven, right?
Well, and I still, with people who
how
are
do you know?
I move away from that. Yeah.
What's that? You want to move away from that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. But they're not, they adopt to it.
Oh, right. So prompts.
Well,
so that is part of the, like, well, something that works, quote unquote, for autistic kids. So why isn't it working for my child, right? Or my own self? Prompts seem to work. Visual strategies work. A schedule, visual schedule works. And in PDA, it does not work. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Well,
if
sorry.
If you're trying to diagnose an autistic, you know, if you're trying to find an autistic diagnosis and you're saying, well, this person doesn't respond to prompts and, you know.
Yeah. It's, they have the opposite.
You might not see it.
Yeah. Right?
Whereas you might think with an autistic child, they only do the things you ask them to do. They have to be prompted.
Yeah.
So let's not miss those folks. You know, I also wonder, like, how early in life does a person recognize that they're living a very different experience than their family members, including their parents, maybe especially their parents? Like, how early in life does a person start to understand that the way they see the world and what they consider to be reasonable and what they consider to make sense doesn't align with their parents? Could that happen at 2 years old? Could that happen at 3 years old?
Well, it depends on the person.
When it does happen, there's an element of needing to examine and validate everything that's asked of them, because the realization might occur that even though you understand, and this might be subconscious, but even though you understand that your parents have your best interests in mind, what they're recommending might not be in your best interests.
I mean, that really speaks back to what we were saying of how parents need more information about what autism is and being able to shift their mindset to better support different types of processing.
Yeah, and it doesn't question anybody's love for their children.
Right.
It's not a question of not wanting to do what's best. But I don't think it is hard for parents to hear, even outside of this whole conversation, that they may not know what's best for their kids.
Yeah.
Not outside of the domain of autism. We see this in a lot of places.
Yeah, I get a little nervous about that because we have a lot of interventions that tell parents, oh, we know better than you do how to support your child. And then they leave the parent out of it. Where
no, yeah.
I fight hard against those because I really think the parents do know their child best. They may not know the autistic processing best, but they know their child, their family, all the other pieces, their child's personality, all of this other stuff.
And they have the mental record of everything that's occurred.
Yeah.
With their, you know, in a way that probably nobody else has, right?
Good
that they're going to be able to do better than anybody else. And so, no, I'm not saying that When I say, you know, may not know what's best for their kid, that kind of leads towards a conversation, and you work in a diagnostic capacity, and that's not where I'm going, right? To say that that anyone else would do a better job, or that institution would do a better job. That's not the direction I'm going. But what I'm saying is that the idea of expanding people's awareness, especially parents, of neurodiversity.
Yeah.
Right. And not trying to ignore it or treat their child like they're neurotypical. We're not going to address the issue because we don't want to.
There's so much there, though, too.
Our child to have a different experience. Well, they are having a different experience. You can't change that, right? Exactly. And when we discover more and more that in all kinds of neurotypes, physical structures to the brain that are different or unique, right? And or the way that the so that's one thing, and the other thing is the way that the neurons fire, right? We build models about what parts of the brain fire during what types of experiences, and across neurotypes are not entirely consistent. So we know that exists. So if we know that exists, what does that look like outside of, you know, these kind of scientific definitions, right? What does that just look like in a day-to-day experience for a family or for a parent child or for friends or peers? You have to translate that for folks and say, this is what you're going to see, this is what you're going to hear, this is what the way this type of person is experiencing the world in a way that's really different than you. And that's something that we can learn about, not only from neurodiversity, but it's just something that would be good. So, you know, for in general, right?
Yes.
So the PDA Society, right, in the UK, has this acronym PANDA, right, of which is kind of a quick way of kind of accessing how to interact or even assist a person. I think it's designed for parents, how to assist a child who has a PDA profile of autism, and it's, you know, PANDA, pick battles, anxiety management, negotiation and collaboration, disguise or manage demands, and adaptation. Okay. Well, you know what? Why not in general? this is like a roadmap for stoicism in a way, right? those are all great. That's all great advice, regardless.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
I'm thinking we do need to wind up, but
okay.
I really like that as recommendations to look at PANDA. I know I get thrown by that acronym because it's also an acronym in the autism community, but for some medical issue stuff.
Oh, okay.
So that throws me off a little bit, but I like that. So pick your battles.
I'll send you the
Decrease in anxiety, et cetera. Right. But I also think a message that we could give to both parents, but for also people who think that they may be on the autism spectrum with a PDA profile would be to let go of typical, number one, which is probably for everybody, but let go of typical and let go of timeframes.
Timeframes. Yeah.
Or I don't know, is it let go of timeframes or is it allow a difference in timeframes? Because I know that, you know, we as parents think that you tell a child something or you tell an adult child something, they should do it right away. But most autistic individuals, PDA profile or not, aren't going to do it right away. They're going to take the message, process it, shift their thinking from whatever it is that they've been doing, et cetera, and they will get to it, but on a different time frame.
Yeah. And that's not only, again, I think not only true of asking someone to do something. I think the time frame in this conversation is relevant in social situations, mm-hmm. in conversations people have, in the way a person structures their life over time.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's something that I hate to say this word again, but I think it's an extremely nuanced exploration.
Yeah.
To consider autism as at least partially a result of the way people experience time and what that means.
So intriguing. Okay. Let's finish up. So that's another podcast we could do about how autistic individuals experience time.
Yeah.
I like that one.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Blake.
Thank you.
Synergy Autism Podcast.